And then we decided about the fire.
We planned it out, I say.
We did. We convinced Bess to take the big boat and all the littles to see a movie on the vineyard.
As Johnny talks, the memories form. I fill in details he hasn't spoken aloud.
When they left, we drank the wine they'd left corked in the fridge, says Johnny. 4 open bottles. That cat was so angry.
He was right, I say. Johnny turns his face and speaks into the floor again.
Because you wasn't coming back. If my mom married Ed, they'd be cut off. And if my mom left Ed, Gat wouldn't be connected to our family anymore.
Claremont was like the symbol of everything that was wrong. It is Mirren's voice. She came in so quietly I didn't hear. She is now lying on the floor next to Johnny, holding his other hand.
The seat of the patriarchy,
says Gat. I didn't hear him come in either. He lies down next to me.
You're such an ass, Gat, says Johnny kindly. You always say patriarchy. It's what I mean. You sneak it in wherever you can. Patriarchy on toast, patriarchy in my pants, patriarchy with a squeeze of lemon.
Claremont seemed like the seat of the patriarchy, repeats Gat. And
yes, we were stupid drunk. And yes, we thought they'd rip the family apart and I would never come here again. We figured if the house was gone, and the paperwork, and data inside it gone, and all the objects they fought about gone, the power would be gone.
We could be a family, says Mirren.
It was like a purification, says Gat. She remembers we set a fire is all, says Johnny, his voice suddenly loud.
And some other things, I add, sitting up and looking at the lyres in the morning light. Things are coming back as you're filling me in.
We are telling you all the stuff that happened before we set the fire, says Johnny, still loud.
Yes, says Mirren.
We set a fire, I say in wonder. We didn't sob and bleed. We did something instead. Made a change.
Kind of, says Mirren.
Are you kidding? We burned that fucking palace to the ground.
Chapter 71. After the aunties and granddad quarreled, I was crying. Gat was crying, too. He was going to leave the island, and I'd never see him again. He would never see me. Gat. My Gat. I had never cried with anyone before, at the same time. He cried like a man, not like a boy. Not like he was frustrated or hadn't gotten his way, but like life was bitter, like his wounds couldn't be healed. I wanted to heal them for him. We ran down to the tiny beach alone. I clung to him and we sat together in the sand, and for once, he had nothing to say. No analysis, no questions. Finally, I said something about, what if we took it into our own hands. And Gat said, how? And I said something about, what if they could stop fighting? We have something to save. And Gat said, yes, you and me and Mirren and Johnny, yes, we do. But of course we can always see each other, the four of us. Next year we can drive. There is always the phone. But here, I said, this. Yes, here, he said, this. you and me. I said something about, what if we could somehow stop being the beautiful Sinclair family and just be a family? What if we could stop being different colors, different backgrounds, and just be in love? What if we could force everyone to change? Force them. You want to play God, Gat said. I want to take action, I said. There is always a phone, he said. But what about here, I said. This. Yes, here, he said. This. Gat was my love. My first and only. How could I let him go? He was a person who couldn't fake a smile but smiled often. He wrapped my wrists in white gauze and believed wounds needed attention. He wrote on his hands and asked me my thoughts. His mind was restless, relentless. He didn't believe in God anymore, and yet he still wished that God would help him. And now he was mine, and I said we should not let our love be threatened. We should not let the family fall apart. We should not accept an evil we can change. We would stand up against it, would we not? Yes, we should. We would be heroes, even. Gad and I talked to Mirren and Johnny, convinced them to take action. We told each other over and over, do what you are afraid to do. We told each other over and over. We said it. We told each other we were right. Chapter 72. The plan was simple. We would find the spare jugs of gas, the ones kept in the shed for the motorboats. There were newspapers and cardboard in the mudroom. We'd build piles of recycling and soak those in gasoline. We'd soak the wood floors as well. Stand back, light a paper towel roll, and throw it. Easy. We would light every floor, every room, if possible, to make sure Claremont burned completely. Gat in the basement, me on the ground floor, Johnny on the second, and Mirren on top.
The fire department arrived really late, says Mirren.
Two fire departments, says Johnny. Woods Hole and Martha's Vineyard.
We were counting on that, I say, realizing.
We planned to call for help, says Johnny. Of course, someone had to call or it would look like arson. We were going to say we were all down at Cuddle Down, watching a movie, and you know how the trees surround it. You can't see the other houses unless you go on the roof. So it made sense that no one would have called. Those fire departments are mainly volunteers, says Gat. No one had a clue. Old Woodhouse. Tinderbox. If the aunts and granddad suspected us, they'd never prosecute, adds Johnny. It was easy to bank on that. Of course they wouldn't prosecute. No one here is a criminal. No one is an addict. No one is a failure. I feel a thrill at what we have done. My full name is Cadence Sinclair Eastman, and contrary to the expectations of the beautiful family in which I was raised, I am an arsonist, a visionary, a heroine, a rebel, the kind of person who changes history, a criminal. But if I am a criminal, am I then an addict? Am I then a failure? My mind is playing with twists of meaning as it always does. We made it happen, I say.
Depends on what you think it is, says Mirren.
We saved the family. They started over.
Aunt Carrie's wandering the island at night, says Mirren. My mother's scrubbing clean sinks till her hands are raw. Penny watches you sleep and writes down what you eat. They drink a fuckload. They're getting drunk until the tears roll down their faces. When are you even at New Claremont to see that? I say.
I get up there now and then, Mirren says.
You think we solved everything, Katie, but I think it was...
We're here, I persist. Without that fire, we wouldn't be here. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Granddad held so much power, I say, and now he doesn't. We changed an evil we saw in the world. I understand so much that wasn't clear before. My tea is warm, the lyres are beautiful, cuddle down is beautiful. It doesn't matter if there are stains on the wall. It doesn't matter if I have headaches or Mirren is sick. It doesn't matter if Will has nightmares and Gat hates himself. We have committed the perfect crime.
Granddad only lacks power because he's demented, says Mirren. He would still torture everybody if he could.
I don't agree with you, says Gat. New Claremont seems like a punishment to me.
What? She asks.
A self-punishment. He built himself a home that isn't a home. It's deliberately uncomfortable.
Why would he do that? I ask.
Why did you give away all your belongings?
Gat asks. He is staring at me. They are all staring at me.
To be charitable, I answer. To do some good in the world.
There is a strange silence.
I hate clutter, I say.
No one laughs.
I don't know how this conversation came to be all about me.
None of the liars speaks for a long time. Then Johnny says,
Don't push it, Gat. And Gat says, I'm glad you remember the fire, Cadence.
And I say, Yeah, well, some of it. And Mirren says she doesn't feel well and goes back to bed. The boys and I lie on the kitchen floor and stare at the ceiling for a while longer, until I realize, with some embarrassment, that they have both fallen asleep. Chapter 73. I find my mother on the Windermere porch with the Goldens. She is crocheting a scarf of pale blue wool.
You're always at Cuddledown, Mommy complains. It's not good to be down there all the time.
Carrie went yesterday looking for something, and she said it was filthy.
What have you been doing?
Nothing. Sorry about the mess.
If it's really dirty, we can't ask Ginny to clean it. You know that, right? It's not fair to her. And Bess will have a fit if she sees it.
I don't want anyone coming in to Cuddledown. I want it just for us.
Don't worry. I sit down and pat Bosch on his sweet yellow head. Listen, Mummy.
Yes.
Why did you tell the family not to talk to me about the fire?
She puts down her yarn and looks at me for a long time.
You remember the fire? Last night, it came rushing back. I don't remember all of it, but yeah, I remember it happened. I remember you all argued and everyone left the island. I remember I was here with Gat, Mirren, and Johnny.
Do you remember anything else?
What the sky looked like with the flames? The smell of the smoke?
If Mummy thinks I am in any way at fault, she will never ever ask me. I know she won't. She doesn't want to know.
I changed the course of her life. I changed the fate of the family, the liars and I. It was a horrible thing to do.
Maybe.
But it was something. It wasn't sitting by complaining. I am a more powerful person than my mother will ever know. I have trespassed against her and helped her too. She strokes my hair. So cloying, I pull back. That's all? She asks. Why doesn't anyone talk to me about it? I repeat. Because of... Mummy stops, looking for words. Because of your pain. Because I have headaches? Because I can't remember my accident? I can't handle the idea that Claremont burned down? The doctors told me not to add stress to your life, she says. They said the fire might have triggered the headaches, whether it was smoke inhalation or fear, she finishes lamely. I'm not a child, I say. I can be trusted to know basic information about our family. All summer I've been working to remember my accident and what happened right before. Why not tell me, Mummy? I did tell you. 2 years ago. I told you over and over, but you never remembered it the next day. And when I talked to the doctor, he said I shouldn't keep upsetting you that way, shouldn't keep pushing you. You live with me, I cry. Don't you have any faith in your own judgment over that of some doctor who barely knows me? He's an expert. What makes you think I'd want my whole extended family keeping secrets from me? Even the twins, even Will and Taft, for God's sake. Rather than know what happened. What makes you think I am so fragile I can't even know simple facts? You seem that fragile to me, says Mommy. And, to be honest, I haven't been sure I could handle your reaction. You can't even imagine how insulting that is. I love you, she says. I can't look at her pitying, self-justifying face any longer. Chapter 74. Mirren is in my room when I open the door. She is sitting at my desk with her hand on my laptop. I wonder if I could read the emails you sent me last year, she says. Do you have them on your computer? Yeah. I never read them, she says. At the start of the summer, I pretended I did, but I never even opened them. Why not? I just didn't, she says. I thought it didn't matter, but now I think it does. And look, she makes her voice light. I even left the house to do it. I swallow as much anger as I can. I understand not writing back, but why wouldn't you even read my emails? I know, Mirren says. It sucks, and I'm a horrible wench. Please, will you let me read them now? I open the laptop, do a search, and find all the notes addressed to her. There are 28. I read over her shoulder. Most of them are charming, darling emails from a person supposedly without headaches. Mirren, tomorrow I leave for Europe with my cheating father, who is, as you know, also deeply boring. Wish me luck and know that I wish I were spending the summer on Beechwood with you and Johnny and even Gat. I know, I should be over it. I am over it. I am. Off to Marbella to meet attractive Spanish boys, so there. I wonder if I can make Dad eat the most disgusting foods of every country we visit as penance for his running off to Colorado. I bet I can. If he really loves me, he will eat frogs and kidneys and chocolate-covered ants. Cadence. That's how most of them go. But a few of the emails are neither charming nor darling. Those ones are pitiful and true. Mirren,
Vermont winter. Dark. Dark. Mummy keeps looking at me while I sleep. My head hurts all the time. I don't know what to do to make it stop. The pills don't work. Someone is splitting through the top of my head with an axe. A messy axe that won't make a clean cut through my skull. Whoever wields it has to hack away at my head, coming down over and over, but not always right in the same place. I have multiple wounds. I dream sometimes that the person wielding the axe is Granddad. Other times the person is me. Other times the person is Gat. Sorry to sound crazy. My hands are shaking as I type this, and the screen is too bright. I want to die sometimes. My head hurts so much. I keep writing you all my brightest thoughts, but I never say the dark ones, even though I think them all the time. So, I am saying them now. Even if you do not answer, I will know somebody heard them. And that, at least, is something. Cadence. We read all 28 emails. When she is finished, Mirren kisses me on the cheek.
I can't even say sorry, she tells me. There is not even a Scrabble word for how bad I feel.
Then she is gone. Chapter 75. I bring my laptop to the bed and create a document. I take down my graph paper notes and begin typing those and all my new memories, fast and with 1,000 errors. I fill in gaps with guesses where I don't have actual recall. The Sinclair Center for Socialization and Snacks. You won't see that boyfriend of yours again. He wants me to stay the hell away from you. We adore Windermere, don't we, Katie? Aunt Terry crying in Johnny's windbreaker. Gat throwing balls for the dogs on the tennis court. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. The dogs. The fucking dogs. Fatima and Prince Philip. The Goldens died in that fire. I know it now, and it is my fault. They were such naughty dogs, not like Bosch, Grendel, and Poppy, who Mummy trained. Fatima and Prince Philip ate starfish on the shore, then vomited them up in the living room. They shook water from their shaggy fur, snarfled people's picnic lunches, chewed frisbees into hunks of unusable plastic. They loved tennis balls and would go down to the court and slime any that had been left around. They would not sit when told. They begged at the table. When the fire caught, the dogs were in one of the guest bedrooms. Granddad often closed them in upstairs while Claremont was empty or at night. That way they wouldn't eat people's boots or howl at the screen door. Granddad had shut them up before he left the island. And we hadn't thought of them. I had killed those dogs. It was I who lived with dogs. I who knew where Prince Philip and Fatima slept. The rest of the liars didn't think about the Goldens. Not very much, anyway. Not like I did. They had burned to death. How could I have forgotten them like that? How could I have been so wrapped up in my own stupid criminal exercise, the thrill of it, my own anger at the aunties and Granddad, Fatima and Prince Philip burning, sniffing at the hot door, breathing in smoke, wagging their tails, hopefully waiting for someone to come and get them, barking. What a horrible death for those poor, dear, naughty dogs. Chapter 76. I run out of Windermere. It is dark out now, nearly time for supper. My feelings leak out my eyes, crumpling my face, heave through my frame as I imagine the dogs, hoping for a rescue, staring at the door as the smoke billows in. Where to go? I cannot face the liars at Cuddledown. Redgate might have Will or Aunt Carrie. The island is so fucking small, actually. There's nowhere to go. I am trapped on this island where I killed those poor, poor dogs.
All my bravado from this morning. The power. The perfect crime. Taking down the patriarchy. The way we liars saved the summer idol and made it better. The way we kept our family together by destroying some part of it. All that is delusional. The dogs are dead. The stupid, lovely dogs. The dogs I could have saved. Innocent dogs whose faces lit when you snuck them a bit of hamburger or even said their names. Dogs who loved to go on boats, who ran free all day on muddy paws. What kind of person takes action without thinking about who might be locked in an upstairs room, trusting the people who have always kept them safe and loved them? I am sobbing these strange, silent sobs, standing on the walkway between Windermere and Redgate. My face is soaked. My chest is contracting. I stumble back home. Gat is on the steps. Chapter 77. He jumps up when he sees me and wraps his arms around me. I sob into his shoulder and tuck my arms under his jacket and around his waist. He doesn't ask what's wrong until I tell him. "The dogs," I say finally. "We killed the dogs." He is quiet for a moment, then,
"Yeah."
I don't speak again until my body stops shaking.
"Let's sit down,"
Gat says. We settle on the porch steps. Gat rests his head against mine. "I loved those dogs," I say.
"We all did."
I choke on my words. I don't think I should talk about it anymore, or I'll start crying again.
"All right."
We sit for a while longer.
"Is that everything?"
Gat asks.
"What?" "Everything you were crying about?"
"God forbid there's more." He is silent, and still silent. "Oh, hell, there is more," I say, and my chest feels hollow and iced.
"Yeah," says Gat. "There is more."
"More that people aren't telling me. More that Mommy would rather I didn't remember." He takes a moment to think.
"I think we're telling you, but you can't hear it. You've been sick, Cadence."
"You're not telling me directly," I say.
"No."
"Why the hell not?"
"Penny said it was best, and, well, with all of us being here, I had faith that you'd remember."
He takes his arm off my shoulder and wraps his hands around his knees. Gat, my Gat. He is contemplation and enthusiasm, ambition and strong coffee. I love the lids of his brown eyes, his smooth, dark skin, his lower lip that pushes out, his mind. I kiss his cheek. "I remember more about us than I used to," I tell him. "I remember you and me kissing at the door of the mudroom before it all went so wrong. You and me on the tennis court talking about Ed proposing to Carrie. On the perimeter at the flat rock where no one could see us. And down on the tiny beach, talking about setting the fire." He nods. "But I still don't remember what went wrong," I say. "Why we weren't together when I got hurt. Did we have an argument? Did I do something? Did you go back to Raquel?" I cannot look him in the eyes. "I think I deserve an honest answer, even if whatever's between us now isn't going to last." Gat's face crumples, and he hides it in his hands.
"I don't know what to do," he says. "I don't know what I'm supposed to do."
"Just tell me," I say.
I can't stay here with you, he says. I have to go back to Cuddle Down.
Why?
I have to, he says, standing up and walking.
Then he stops and turns.
I messed everything up. I'm so sorry, Katie. I am so, so sorry.
He is crying again.
I shouldn't have kissed you or made you a tire swing or given you roses. I shouldn't have told you how beautiful you are.
I wanted you to.
I know, but I should have stayed away. It's fucked up that I did all that. I'm sorry.
Come back here, I say. But when he doesn't move, I go to him. Put my hands on his neck and my cheek against his. I kiss him hard so he knows I mean it. His mouth is so soft, and he's just the best person I know. The best person I've ever known. No matter what bad things have happened between us, and no matter what happens after this. I love you, I whisper. He pulls back.
This is what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. I just wanted to see you.
He turns around and is lost in the dark. Chapter 78. The hospital on Martha's Vineyard. Summer 15 after my accident. I was lying in a bed under blue sheets. You would think hospital sheets would be white, but these were blue. The room was hot. I had an IV in one arm. Mummy and Granddad were staring down at me. Granddad was holding a box of Edgartown fudge he'd brought as a gift. It was touching that he remembered I liked the Edgartown fudge. I was listening to music with earbuds in my ears so I couldn't hear what the adults were saying. Mummy was crying. Granddad opened the fudge, broke off a piece, and offered it to me. The song. Our youth is wasted. We will not waste it. Remember my name, 'cause we made history. Na-na-na-na, na-na-na. I lifted my hand to take out the earbuds. The hand I saw was bandaged. Both my hands were bandaged. And my feet. I could feel the tape on them, beneath the blue sheets. My hands and feet were bandaged because they were burned. Chapter 79. Once upon a time, there was a king who had three beautiful daughters. No, wait. Once upon a time, there were three bears who lived in a wee house in the woods. Once upon a time, there were three billy goats who lived near a bridge. Once upon a time, there were three soldiers tramping together down the roads after the war. Once upon a time, there were three little pigs. Once upon a time, there were three brothers. No, this is it. This is the variation I want. Once upon a time, there were three beautiful children, two boys and a girl. When each baby was born, the parents rejoiced, the heavens rejoiced, even the fairies rejoiced. The fairies came to christening parties and gave the babies magical gifts. Bounce, effort, and snark. Contemplation and enthusiasm. Ambition and strong coffee. Sugar, curiosity, and rain. And yet, there was a witch. There is always a witch. This witch was the same age as the beautiful children. And as she and they grew, she was jealous of the girl and jealous of the boys, too. They were blessed with all these fairy gifts, gifts the witch had been denied at her own christening. The eldest boy was strong and fast, capable and handsome, though it's true he was exceptionally short. The next boy was studious and open-hearted, though it's true he was an outsider. And the girl was witty, generous, and ethical, though it's true she felt powerless.
the witch. She was none of these things, for her parents had angered the fairies. No gifts were ever bestowed upon her. She was lonely. Her only strength was her dark and ugly magic. She confused being Spartan with being charitable, and gave away her possessions without truly doing good with them. She confused being sick with being brave, and suffered agonies while imagining she merited praise for it. She confused wit with intelligence, and made people laugh rather than lightening their hearts or making them think. Her magic was all she had, and she used it to destroy what she most admired. She visited each young person in turn on their 10th birthday, but did not harm them outright. The protection of some kind fairy, the lilac fairy perhaps, prevented her from doing so. What she did instead was curse them. "When you are 16, proclaimed the witch in a rage of jealousy. "When we are all 16, she told these beautiful children, "you shall prick your finger on a spindle. No, you shall strike a match. Yes, you will strike a match and die in its flame." The parents of the beautiful children were frightened of the curse and tried, as people will do, to avoid it. They moved themselves and the children far away to a castle on a windswept island, a castle where there were no matches. There, surely, they would be safe. There, surely, the witch would never find them. But find them she did. And when they were 15, these beautiful children, just before their 16th birthdays, and when their nervous parents were not yet expecting it, the jealous witch brought her toxic, hateful self into their lives in the shape of a blonde maiden. The maiden befriended the beautiful children. She kissed them and took them on boat rides and brought them fudge and told them stories. Then she gave them a box of matches. The children were entranced, for at nearly 16 they had never seen fire. "Go on, strike," said the witch, smiling. "Fire is beautiful. Nothing bad will happen." "Go on," she said. "The flames will cleanse your souls." "Go on," she said, "for you are independent thinkers." "Go on," she said. "What is this life we lead if you do not take action?" And they listened. They took the matches from her and they struck them. The witch watched their beauty burn. Their bounce, their intelligence, their wit, their open hearts, their charm, their dreams for the future. She watched it all disappear in smoke. Part 5. Truth. Chapter 80. Here is the truth about the beautiful Sinclair family. At least, the truth as Granddad knows it. The truth he was careful to keep out of all newspapers. One night, 2 summers ago, on a warm July evening, Gatwick Matthew Patil, Miran Sinclair Sheffield, and Jonathan Sinclair Dennis perished in a house fire thought to be caused by a jug of motorboat fuel that overturned in the mudroom. The house in question burned to the ground before the neighboring fire departments arrived on the scene. Cadence Sinclair Eastman was present on the island at the time of the fire, but did not notice it until it was well underway. The conflagration prevented her from entering the building when she realized there were people and animals trapped inside. She sustained burns to the hands and feet in her rescue attempts. Then she ran to another home on the island and telephoned the fire department. When help finally arrived, Miss Eastman was found on the tiny beach, half underwater and curled into a ball.
She was unable to answer questions about what happened and appeared to have suffered a head injury. She had to be heavily sedated for many days following the accident. Harris Sinclair, owner of the island, declined any formal investigation of the fire's origin. Many of the surrounding trees were decimated. Funerals were held for Gatwick Matthew Patil, Miran Sinclair Sheffield, and Jonathan Sinclair Dennis in their hometowns of Cambridge and New York City. Caden Sinclair Eastman was not well enough to attend. The following summer, the Sinclair family returned to Beechwood Island. They fell apart. They mourned. They drank a lot. Then they built a new house on the ashes of the old. Caden Sinclair Eastman had no memory of the events surrounding the fire, no memory of it ever happening. Her burns healed quickly, but she exhibited selective amnesia regarding the events of the previous summer. She persisted in believing she had injured her head while swimming. Doctors presumed her crippling migraine headaches were caused by unacknowledged grief and guilt. She was heavily medicated and extremely fragile, both physically and mentally. These same doctors advised Cadence's mother to stop explaining the tragedy if Cadence could not recall it herself. It was too much to be told of the trauma fresh each day. Let her remember in her own time. She should not return to Beechwood Island until she'd had significant time to heal. In fact, any measures possible should be taken to keep her from the island in the year immediately after the accident. Cadence displayed a disquieting desire to rid herself of all unnecessary possessions, even things of sentimental value, almost as if doing penance for past crimes. She darkened her hair and took to dressing very simply. Her mother sought professional advice about Cadence's behavior and was advised that it appeared a normal part of the grieving process. In the second year after the accident, the family began to recover. Cadence was once again attending school after many long absences. Eventually, the girl expressed a desire to return to Beechwood Island. The doctors and other family members agreed. It might be good for her to do just that. On the island, perhaps, she would finish healing. Chapter 81. Remember, don't get your feet wet, or your clothes. Soak the linen cupboards, the towels, the floors, the books, and the beds. Remember, move the gas can away from your kindling so you can grab it. See it catch, see it burn, then run. Use the kitchen stairwell and exit out the mudroom door. Remember, take your gas can with you and return it to the boathouse. See you at Cuddledown. We'll put our clothes in the washer there, change, then go and watch the blaze before we call the fire departments. Those are the last words I said to any of them. Johnny and Miran went to the top two floors of Claremont, carrying cans of gas and bags of old newspapers for kindling. I kissed Gat before he went down to the basement.
See you in a better world, he said to me, and I laughed.
We were a bit drunk. We'd been at the auntie's leftover wine since they'd left the island. The alcohol made me feel giddy and powerful until I stood in the kitchen alone. Then I felt dizzy and nauseated. The house was cold. It felt like something that deserved to be destroyed. It was filled with objects over which the aunties fought. Valuable art, china, photographs. All of them fueled family anger. I hit my fist against the kitchen portrait of Mummy, Carrie, and Bess's children grinning for the camera. The glass on it shattered, and I stumbled back. The wine was muddling my head now. I wasn't used to it. The gas can in one hand and the bag of kindling in the other, I decided to get this done as fast as possible. I doused the kitchen first, then the pantry, I did the dining room and was soaking the living room couches when I realized I should have started at the end of the house farthest from the mudroom door. That was our exit. I should have done the kitchen last so I could run out without wetting my feet with gasoline. Stupid! The formal door that opened onto the front porch from the living room was soaked already, but there was a small back door, too. It was by Granddad's study and led to the walkway down to the staff building. I would use that. I doused part of the hall and then the craft room, feeling a wave of sorrow for the ruin of Gran's beautiful cotton prints and colorful yarns. She would have hated what I was doing. She loved her fabrics, her old sewing machine, her pretty, pretty objects. Stupid again! I had soaked my espadrilles in fuel. All right, stay calm. I'd wear them until I was done and then toss them into the fire behind me as I ran outside. In Granddad's study, I stood on the desk, splashing bookshelves up to the ceiling, holding the gas can far away from me. There was a fair amount of gas left, and this was my last room, so I soaked the books heavily. Then I wet the floor, piled the kindling on it, and backed into the small foyer that led to the rear door. I got my shoes off and threw them onto the stack of magazines. I stepped onto a square of dry floor and set the gas can down, pulled a matchbook from the pocket of my jeans, and lit my paper towel roll. I threw the flaming roll into the kindling and watched it light. It caught and grew and spread. Through the double wide study doors, I saw a line of flame zip down the hallway on one side and into the living room on the other. The couch lit up. Then, before me, the bookshelves burst into flames, the gas-soaked paper burning quicker than anything else. Suddenly, the ceiling was alight. I couldn't look away. The flames were terrible, unearthly. Then someone screamed. And screamed again. It was coming from the room directly above me. A bedroom. Johnny was working on the second floor. I had lit the study, and the study had burned faster than anywhere else. The fire was rising, and Johnny wasn't out. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. I threw myself at the back door, but found it heavily bolted. My hands were slippery with gas. The metal was hot already. I flipped the bolts, 1, 2, 3, but something went wrong, and the door stuck. Another scream. I tried the bolts again. Failed. Gave up. I covered my mouth and nose with my hands and ran through the burning study and down the flaming hallway into the kitchen. The room wasn't lit yet, thank God. I rushed across the wet floor toward the mudroom door. Stumbled, skidded, and fell, soaking myself in the puddles of gasoline. The hems of my jeans were burning from my run through the study. The flames licked out to the gas on the kitchen floor and streaked across to the wooden farmhouse cabinetry and Gran's cheery dish towels. Fire zipped across the mudroom exit in front of me, and I could see my jeans were now alight as well from knee to ankle. I hurled myself through the mudroom door, running through flames. "Get out!" I yelled, though I doubted anyone could hear me. "Get out now!" Outside, I threw myself onto the grass, rolled until my pants stopped burning. I could see already that the top two floors of Claremont were glowing with heat, and my own ground floor was fully alight. The basement level, I couldn't tell. "Gat? Johnny? Mirren? Where are you?" No answer. Holding down panic, I told myself they must be out by now. Calm down. It would all be okay. It had to. "Where are you?" I yelled again, beginning to run. Again, no answer. They were likely at the boathouse, dropping their gas cans. It wasn't far, and I ran, calling their names as loud as I could. My bare feet hit the wooden walkway with a strange echo. The door was closed. I yanked it open. "Gat? Johnny? Mirren?" No one there. But they could already be at Cuddledown, couldn't they? Wondering what was taking me so long. A walkway stretches from the boathouse past the tennis courts and over to Cuddledown. I ran again, the island strangely hushed in the dark. I told myself over and over, they will be there, waiting for me, worrying about me. We will laugh because we're all safe. We will soak my burns in ice water and feel all kinds of lucky. We will. But as I came upon it, I saw the house was dark. No one waited there. I tore back to Claremont, and when it came into view, it was burning, bottom to top. The turret room was lit. The bedrooms were lit. The windows of the basement glowed orange, everything hot. I ran to the mudroom entry and pulled the door. Smoke billowed out. I pulled off my gas-soaked sweater and jeans, choking and gagging. I pushed my way in and entered the kitchen stairwell, heading toward the basement. Halfway down the steps, there was a wall of flames. A wall. Gat wasn't out, and he wasn't coming. I turned back and ran up toward Johnny and Mirren, but the wood was burning beneath my feet. The banister lit up. The stairwell in front of me caved in, throwing sparks. I reeled back. I could not go up. I could not save them. There was nowhere. 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 Nowhere now to go. But down. Chapter 82. I remember this like I am living it as I sit on the steps of Windermere, still staring at the spot where Gat disappeared into the night. The realization of what I have done comes as a fog in my chest, cold, dark, and spreading. I grimace and hunch over. The icy fog runs from my chest through my back and up my neck. It shoots through my head and down my spine. Cold, cold remorse. I shouldn't have soaked the kitchen first. I shouldn't have lit the fire in the study. How stupid to wet the book so thoroughly. Anyone might have predicted how they would burn. Anyone. We should have had a set time to light our kindling. I might have insisted we stay together. I should never have checked the boathouse. Should never have run to Cuddle Down. If only I'd gone back to Claremont faster, maybe I could have gotten Johnny out or worn Gat before the basement caught. Maybe I could have found the fire extinguishers and stopped the flames somehow. Maybe. Maybe. If only. If only. I wanted so much for us. A life free of constriction and prejudice. A life free to love and be loved. And here, I have killed them. My wires. My darlings. Killed them. My Mirren, my Johnny, my Gat. This knowledge goes from my spine, down my shoulders, and through my fingertips. It turns them to ice. They chip and break, tiny pieces shattering on the Windermere steps. Cracks splinter at my arms and through my shoulders and the front of my neck. My face is frozen and fractured in a witch's snarl of grief. My throat is closed. I cannot make a sound. Here I am frozen when I deserve to burn. I should have shut up about taking things into our own hands. I could have stayed silent, compromised. Talking on the phone would have been fine. Soon we'd have driver's licenses. Soon we'd go to college, and the beautiful Sinclair houses would seem far away and unimportant. We could have been patient. I could have been a voice of reason. Maybe then, when we drank the auntie's wine, we'd have forgotten our ambitions. The drink would have made us sleepy. We'd have dozed off in front of the television set. Angry and impotent, perhaps, but without setting fire to anything. I can't take any of it back. I crawl indoors and up to my bedroom on hands of cracked ice, trailing shards of my frozen body behind me. My heels
my kneecaps. Beneath the blankets, I shiver convulsively, pieces of me breaking off into my pillow. Fingers, teeth, jawbone, collarbone. Finally, the shivering stops. I begin to warm and melt. I cry for my aunts who lost their firstborn children. For Will, who lost his brother. For Liberty, Bonnie, and Taft, who lost their sister. For Granddad, who saw not just his palace burn to the ground, but his grandchildren perish. For the dogs, the poor, naughty dogs. I cry for the vain, thoughtless complaints I've made all summer. For my shameful self-pity. For my plans for the future. I cry for all my possessions given away. I miss my pillow, my books, my photographs. I shudder at my delusions of charity, at my shame masquerading as virtue, at lies I've told myself, punishments I've inflicted on myself, and punishments I've inflicted on my mother. I cry with horror that all the family has been burdened by me, and even more with being the cause of so much grief. We did not, after all, save the idol. That is gone forever, if it ever existed. We have lost the innocence of it, of those days before we knew the extent of the aunt's rage, before Gran's death and Granddad's deterioration, before we became criminals, before we became ghosts. The aunties hug one another not because they are freed of the weight of Claremont House and all it symbolized, but out of tragedy and empathy. Not because we freed them, but because we wrecked them, and they clung to one another in the face of horror. Johnny. Johnny wanted to run a marathon. He wanted to go mile upon mile, proving his lungs would not give out, proving he was the man Granddad wanted him to be, proving his strength, though he was so small. His lungs filled with smoke. He has nothing to prove now. There is nothing to run for. He wanted to own a car and eat fancy cakes he saw in bakery windows. He wanted to laugh big and own art and wear beautifully made clothes, sweaters, scarves, woolly items with stripes. He wanted to make a tuna fish of Lego and hang it like a piece of taxidermy. He refused to be serious. He was infuriatingly unserious, but he was as committed to the things that mattered to him as anyone could possibly be. The running, Will and Carrie, the liars, his sense of what was right. He gave up his college fund without a second thought to stand up for his principles. I think of Johnny's strong arms, the stripe of white sunblock on his nose, the time we were sick together from poison ivy and lay next to each other in the hammock scratching. The time he built me and Marin a dollhouse of cardboard and stones he'd found on the beach. Jonathan Sinclair Dennis. You would have been a light in the dark for so many people. You have been one. You have. And I let you down the worst possible way. I cry for Mirren, who wanted to see the Congo. She didn't know how she wanted to live or what she believed yet. She was searching and knew she was drawn to that place. It will never be real to her now. Never anything more than photographs and films and stories published for people's entertainment. Mirren talked a lot about sexual intercourse, but never had it. When we were younger, she and I would stay up late sleeping together on the Windermere porch in sleeping bags, laughing and eating fudge. We fought over Barbie dolls and did each other's makeup and dreamed of love. Mirren will never have a wedding with yellow roses, or a groom who loves her enough to wear a stupid yellow cummerbund. She was irritable and bossy, but always funny about it. It was easy to make her mad. And she was nearly always cross with Bess and annoyed with the twins.
but then she'd fill with regret, moaning in agony over her own sharp tongue. She did love her family, loved all of them, and would read them books or